Radio City, John Grayson, Rob Ross, and a brand new year on the broadcast, or at least the podcast portion of the broadcast, as we've been doing this for many, many years now, but online now officially for a year and a week. And Rob, how's everything going in New York City?
Not bad. As you and I had just previously discussed before we went on air, weird weather here, you know, 62 degrees on Thursday, 50 degrees on Friday, and then snow last night. And that went back to about 55 or so.
Yeah, we had something similar. It was 80 degrees here on Thursday, and we got a little snow Saturday morning. So 2 days later, snow was falling. But it was one of those where it was just barely 32 degrees Saturday morning when the snow started falling. So an hour after it fell, it was gone completely.
And, of course, now this week we're expecting allegedly 72 on this coming Wednesday. So
right.
Who knows? I mean, all I can say is this. People around me are still sick and or getting sick. I have yet to completely get this, whatever it is, out of my system because I still have a bit of congestion. And it seems to linger as far as I found out for most of the people I know who've had this. So the weather really isn't helping things.
No. And we talked to an allergist last week who said, you know, what this is going to do is the extended flu season is going to go right into allergy season. So we're going to go from one to the other. And there's every possibility that you and I and people like us are going to go from hacking and coughing because of the flu right into hacking and coughing and sneezing and snotting because of the allergies. Yippee!
Well, I'm good at hacking, coughing, and sneezing, and especially snotting, just in general, and will. I don't have allergies, thank God, except to people.
Yeah.
But with that one exception, you know, but I'll stock up enough phlegm in my system to give everybody a good what for.
Yeah, attaboy. Well, in typical fashion, as the world begins to wake from the winter, from the dead of winter anyway, we get into people giving us plenty to talk about because there's no shortage of stupidity out there in the world, starting on the movie screens where people found a reason to get themselves pissed off over Peter Rabbit. I can't even keep track anymore about all the things I'm supposed to be outraged about and just can't honestly give a shit.
Except just to mock these stupid bastards as they go along, because it's only getting worse. I mean, okay, let's here's the setup, and here's the first thing I'm going to say, just to frame it completely. We're talking about a beloved children's classic, okay? This is a fictional story involving fictional characters. Do you understand that, people?
Right.
Fictional characters.
You mean rabbits don't actually talk? Fruit. Wait a minute.
Right, and it's a cartoon / animated movie. Animation, which equals cartoon, which equals, again, fictional characters.
Right.
Now, somebody somewhere and a group of somebodies somewhere, although they're really a bunch of nobodies going nowhere fast, decided that they were going to get pissed off because one of the characters – and remember, it's supposed to be a cartoon, which usually equals some funniness, some humor – makes a joke about being allergic to blackberries. And thus, the outrage begins, and people want to boycott this movie because they're mocking people with food allergies. Okay, you precious little petals. If I ever find out who any of you are, I am personally going to take a bushel full of blackberries and pour it over you. And
right.
Then I will find a basket of mixed peanuts and dump it all over you.
Yeah.
Because this is just beyond my comprehension. This goes into a realm of stupidity that I cannot fathom.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I mean, how many times when we were kids did we hear, you know, the most violent show on TV is the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour? Because, yeah, of course it is. I mean, he's, you know, the coyote's trying to drop anvils and shit on the Roadrunner. That's the whole driver behind the action. How many times did Daffy Duck get shot? And it's a cartoon. We all knew it was a cartoon. We all realized it was a cartoon when we were four. We don't give our kids any credit. We don't give anybody any credit. And we think, oh, everything is something to get outraged about. And it isn't. And with this particular movie, people forget, as you said, it was a beloved children's story, but we look at the past with rosy-colored glasses always. And what we forget is that Flopsy, Mopsy, and Cottontail were just kind of the henchmen. Peter Rabbit was kind of a dick, you know? That's
right.
Who he was. He was always getting in trouble on purpose. And that's the whole point of the story. So when they decide to try to kill Farmer Brown by taking advantage of his allergies, it is no different than any other cartoon violence. None.
And the thing about cartoon violence in our generation, and this is the whole problem, it's a generational shift, because now we're in that generation of, and I'm using the term very loosely, adults and their kids. This generation of adults are the generation of idiots who were brought up by idiot parents.
Right.
Okay. That's why we've reached a new apex of stupidity. Our parents brought us up to be very common sense, you know, rational thinking human beings. You know, the old fashioned, if you stick a fork in an electric socket and you get a shock, don't do it again.
Right. Right.
If you touch a hot iron, you're going to get burned. Don't do it again. If you're allergic to chocolate, don't eat it again. A very simple process. I know it's a great stretch, and it's very lofty for these later generations to even remotely comprehend, because all of it is based around the whole, my kid can do whatever he wants on the one hand.
Right.
And the other thing is just being uninformed and ignorant.
Well, and there was a shift. I mean, there was an even greater shift from our grandparents' generation to our parents, because I remember being horrified at learning that there were people who actually tried to teach their kids about the hot stove by burning the kid's hand on the hot stove on purpose. That's abusive. I mean, yes, that's obviously wrong. So our parents didn't do that. My dad, just the only thing that he protected me from was stuff that could actually kill me. And beyond that, it was go learn your lessons, kid. Go out there and learn your lessons, and I'll make you feel better if you get hurt on the way.
Right. I mean, you and I have both taken a couple of shots of Black Flag here and there. You know, a urinal cake that hadn't been peed on looks tempting. You know, I mean, let's face it. You have a cousin who annoys you to the nth degree. Put it on her plate, right, as long as it's dry. That way you can fish it out of the urinal. Put it on her plate, cover it in a couple of daisies and, you know, little bits of frosting, and, you know, let her go to town.
Well, they call it a cake. I mean, what do they want us to do with the damn thing?
Let them eat cake. The thing is, you've got these stupid assholes, and that's the only thing that can be referred to, who just need, yet again, and this goes back to something that's a recurring theme, and I wish it wasn't on this show, but it's this need, this incessant need for people to just wake up in the morning and get pissed off about something.
Yep.
Anything but something. You know, and the whole thing with you know, this food allergies shit. Hey, guess what? A lot of us have allergies to certain things. I don't expect the world to pad its corners for me because I'm allergic to penicillin.
My favorite thing when I was a kid, of all the Warner Brothers cartoons, and I mean, we've been over this before. I know I Like to Sing a Thing is one with you, and everybody's got their favorites. But the Wabbit Season, Duck Season thing, where Daffy Duck gets shot in the face over and over and over again. I must have watched that thing 1,000 times when I was a kid. I never got finished watching that and thought, you know, I should go shoot somebody in the face.
But John, here's the thing. I mean, you know, you bring up that one. What's the most one of the most notorious, especially with the duck episodes? Girl, you better hold on to your boyfriend for this. When he takes the nitroglycerin and drinks it down.
Right.
And then swallows the match. You know, and he finally gets the applause from the audience and blows himself up.
Yeah.
You know, I've never had an inkling. Well, okay, I've had an inkling to pour it down somebody's throat, you know, and make it go boom. But that's you know, that's revenge. That's different,
right?
You know, but it's also the same thing that goes along with, you know, what happened after these little retards. And again, we're using retards in the right vernacular. Decide after watching Beavis and Butthead, again a cartoon, Beavis and Butthead, and set their trailer on fire because they lived in a trailer park. Well,
right.
Let the punishment fit the crime.
Let's start with the fact that they lived in a trailer park. And by the way, did you ever sneak one of your grandfather's nitroglycerin pills and whack it with a hammer just to see if it would explode?
No, but that would be really cool.
Just insane. So
this is what we get now. We've allowed this to happen. That's the problem. We've allowed it to happen. Nobody ever anywhere seems to just stop these people and say, wait just a moment.
Yeah, you're being an idiot.
You're being a complete moron. This is a cartoon. This has nothing to do with you. And even if you have a food allergy, it's a cartoon.
Yeah.
This is called a joke. Take the pole out of your ass.
Exactly. Okay? Yep. And it's not the only thing that's on the big screens. And, you know, the shooting thing will bring us eventually to what happened in Florida this week. But before we get there, there was another huge movie opening this week. And the movie critic on our show, who is also our producer, Max Foisy, loved Black Panther. And this thing has been getting rave reviews from the critics, but it's been getting a little bit more than that. Let's face it, it's another movie based on a comic book. It's another superhero movie. So on that level, big deal. But in the same way that people want to imbue some kind of social commentary into Peter Rabbit and the allergy thing, this movie has also now had hung on its back the fact that, well, it's the first Black Marvel superhero. Can it just be an entertaining movie? I would be more than happy for it just to be that.
No, the answer, unfortunately, again, is no, because there are these stupid assholes out there, and they're going to be Black special interest groups and white apologists and those who feel guilty about being white. And this is not a racist comment. This is just a fact of who these people are. You know, the social justice warriors and virtue signalers are out there making a big – first of all, is it really that good of a movie? That's a question. That's number one. You know, let us be the judge of it before saying, oh, it's the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Right.
Really? I saw Hamilton. I didn't think that was the greatest thing on Broadway since sliced bread. REM weren't the greatest band on the planet since sliced – well, maybe they were. since Banana Bread.
Right.
You know, the point is that you people – and I mean all of you stupid bastards out there, and I don't care what color, what race, what your thing is, all of you stupid bastards who have to jump on these bandwagons prematurely, you know, over a fictional character.
Mm-hmm.
There's something seriously wrong in your makeup. God sent you the wrong DNA combination. It's that simple. And really, he just needs to remove you now from the equation because you got to go.
Right.
It's so tedious and it's so tiresome. It's a fictional fucking character. And if you're going to sit there and say to me, especially the way they've been doing it on television and whatnot, about how, you know, how important this is that Black Panther is a Black Panther doesn't exist.
Right.
How's that? Did I burst your bubble? Aw, too bad. Are you triggered now? Do you need a safe space? Good. Take your friends, go in, and I'll burn the safe space down with it. You want a Black superhero that was a fictional character but somebody you could look up to? Call John Shaft.
Yeah, there you go. And if you want a Black superhero, well, Muhammad Ali unfortunately died. But the thing is, you know, you look at a movie like this, like Black Panther, and you think, all right, it should have been this way all along. Yes, there should have been peppered in with all of the other superheroes. There should have been a Black one. There should have been a Hispanic one. There should have been this or that. And those characters do show up from time to time. But yes, Hollywood has a tendency to overrepresent the majority. They have a tendency to overrepresent, first of all, not only white guys, gorgeous white guys, and not only white women, gorgeous white women. So us ugly schlubs, we got no representation either. But when it comes,
you speak for yourself. We are heroes. You and I are cape wearing superheroes.
Oh yeah, well, I forgot.
We're flesh and blood human beings.
But
God damn it,
right? But when you, I was told back in the 70s that the enlightened person doesn't give a shit. That, you know, I remember it being a big deal, and I can't pick a particular character out of my head right now, but there have been some. Oh, I'll tell you what, George Romero did it for us in 1968 with Night of the Living Dead. In that movie, the hero of that movie, the conscience of that movie, was a Black man and did not have to be. The character was not a Black character. He was just the guy who happened to be there in the house.
Right.
So,
right.
So that's what I was told. That's the enlightened portion of this, is it doesn't matter if, you know, if that character is Black or white. So if that's the case, then why does it matter that this character is Black?
Because people are so – you know what this really is when you think about it? This is people not being socially conscious, caring, aware, whatever cliches you want to hang on it. These are shallow, empty people who have nothing better to do than to hang themselves on a hook that has the label above it that says, you know, I'm sort of the modern Black person who's conscious of my Blackness, and that's all I've got to offer. Or
okay.
I feel guilty about being white. So, you know, okay, here's a couple of bits and pieces for you people who don't understand. This is a Marvel comic character, a character that was created by a couple of white Jewish guys.
Yeah.
Okay. you know, very few people, and it was never mentioned in any of the movies. Let's go back. You want to talk about fucking ethnicity? Okay, here we go. Let's have a little fun with ethnicity. Let's look at the Fantastic Four when they did them on film. Okay, you have a very Hispanic-looking woman.
Right.
Right? Her brother is played by a very Aryan-looking guy. Right?
Yep.
The character of the Thing, Ben Grimm, originally when you read the quote backstory on the Thing is he's a Jew.
Yeah, Benjamin, right.
That's number one. But it's never an essential element to it. They did a stupid reboot of the Fantastic Four, and suddenly the brother and sister were black and white with a black father. Now, the illogic behind making that story work that way is simply because it kowtows to people. Yeah. I get that. Right. But the thing is, it didn't play into the storyline. It didn't matter. It was their brother and sister. That's their father. End of the fucking story. You know, I don't think we need to go into depth about it. But this one, everybody has to single out. Meanwhile, everybody bitched about Gal Gadot playing Wonder Woman. Granted, it was DC, not Marvel. But they bitched about her because she's not American. Worse, she's a
Jew.
Right. She's Israeli.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Out of all the DC Comics films, that's the only one that was a success. And you can bet your bottom dollar that part of the reason why it simply was great to look at her.
Yeah.
I didn't care about the storyline. I could look at her for 2 hours. Right. You know? The bottom line is, when you watch a Marvel Comics, Marvel Comics film, I should say, sorry. You know, like when you watch any of the Avengers movies, do you sit there and you go to yourself, Robert Downey Jr., Tony Stark, what is he? Well, you know Robert Downey Jr. is a half a Jew. Scarlett Johansson, she's a Jew.
Right.
Ruffalo, he's Italian. Wait a minute. That guy who plays the Hulk, right? Isn't that the name of the character?
Uh-huh.
He's a black man. Oh, right. My God. There is a black superhero in here.
Right.
Wait a minute. And, of course, Captain America, you know? People, it's a comic book adaptation.
Right.
This is not real life. And if your superheroes are comic book characters, you sorely need therapy and you desperately to grow up.
Yeah, and one of my favorite things to do when I hear people, you know, the Trump acolytes spouting off about the wall and all of this shit is, you know, I ask them, what did you do? Because they always talk about what a great privilege it is to be an American and how these people, you know, they're skipping the line and they should have to work for it. And my favorite thing to ask those assholes is, what did you do? What did you do to become an American? Well, I was born here. Oh, so the answer is you did nothing. Okay.
Well, I got a gun.
Well, yeah, exactly. But it's my birthright. Yeah. You had no control over that, so don't give me any shit. And it's the same thing with whiteness and the stupidity of the white power movement, and it's the same thing with blackness. You didn't do anything to accomplish that. It was done for you.
Right. And guess what else? If you really want to, you know, put paid to this whole notion of, like, the whites are, you know, more privileged than the blacks, and the blacks are oppressed. And all. Stop going on and on about it, and just try and get to know each other.
Right.
Why don't you just start within your own orbit, like your own neighbors?
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I will beat the drum about is my own neighborhood, because I really almost never have seen anybody around here with any of those attitudes. We're all neighbors. Mm-hmm. We all care about the neighborhood. We care about our building. You know, when we see each other, we say hello.
Right.
It's not this kind of look of suspicion. And mind you, I live maybe two blocks at best from where the Eric Garner thing happened. You know what? Here's the bottom line on that. When all is said and done, a career criminal with a 5-sheet-long rap sheet, you know, shouldn't have been swinging his arms at the cops, period. It starts right there. You pick your hands up to the cops, whoever you are, you're going to find trouble. And then some.
Right.
But nobody in our neighborhood torched the place. Nobody had riots. Nobody made anything more than peaceful protests. I understand that people were angry and upset about it. And you know what? They did it the right way.
Yeah.
You voice your opinion.
And it can be. And that's the point, is it can be done the right way. And things like this can, you know, let Black Panther stand or fall on whether or not it's a good movie, period. That's all I give a shit about when I go to see a movie is it a good movie? Does it tell its story effectively? And if it does, great. And if it doesn't, don't tell me how awesome a thing it is outside of being a lousy movie. So.
Right. What was the last one? Was it Captain America Civil War? Was that Civil War?
I think so. I didn't see it.
I didn't think anything of it. I thought it was really flat, frankly.
Right.
But the Marvel movie before that was Ant-Man, and I really dug Ant-Man. Now, am I sitting there thinking in my mind, oh, look, your first Jew, superhero, you know, but the thing is, the character of Ant-Man isn't. It just so happens that the actor who plays him, Paul Rudd, is just so Jewy you can't escape it. I mean, that it's just, you know, you see him and you go, oh, get me a Jew. I want Paul Rudd, you know?
Yeah. So I don't know. I can't, like I said, I can't bring myself. I have enough trouble just going to a movie and letting myself go and suspending disbelief and all of that. I don't need to have some kind of
political message, social
responsibility. I don't want responsibility when I go to a movie. Oh, I have to pay attention to the deeper message. No, right. No, just tell me a story.
Fucking entertain me. It's like going to a concert and being preached at. You pay X amounts of dollars, you know, allow me to be entertained. If you're not going to do your job, I'm going to have something to say about that.
On the other hand, and I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, Roger Waters, get over yourself. But on the other hand, this stupid slap fight that has now erupted between that foghorn Laura Ingraham, Jesus, what a voice, between her and LeBron James. She's pissed off because LeBron James said Donald Trump only cares about himself. Let's start with this. A, he's right. Donald Trump only cares about himself. B, she went after him and said, shut up and dribble. All right. Now, and I will get on his ass too, because his response to that was implied that there was a racial component to what she said. And I don't think there was. But anyway, Laura Ingraham, look. Everybody in the country, I don't care who it is, I don't care if it's a singer, a basketball player, a commentator, a politician, everybody has exactly the same right to say whatever the fuck they want to say. And until those people get it through, I hate it when people say, why doesn't he just sing and not say anything? You know what? Because he's a human being and he's an American and he can say whatever the hell he wants to say. And I don't think, you know, that Laura Ingraham, who, you know, if she's going to get on LeBron James's case because, well, he's a basketball player, what right does he have to say something about politics, would have the same opinion if it was, oh, I don't know, Ted Nugent spouting off his right-wing crap. I don't think she would say, why don't you just shut up and sing? She's a hypocrite and an idiot, and she needs to lay off.
Well, that's true, but that kind of goes without saying. I mean, the bottom line is it falls between two very clear, you know, sides of the issue. One, as you said, because they have every right, especially if they're born in the United States, they have the God-given right as an American citizen to say whatever the hell you have to say, right or wrong, whether we agree with them.
Right.
You know, it's that simple. You know, you have the right to say that Big Star is the greatest thing to happen to music since sliced bread, and I have every right to applaud you and agree with you. Now, on the flip side, you know, you can call someone to test because if you are indeed spending a lot of hard-earned money to see that person perform in a sporting forum, on a stage as a concert performer, going to a movie to see them, and you don't agree with what they're saying, you have a right to voice that discontent and displeasure. But you also have a way of doing it very simply by letting other people know and no longer supporting them. Don't see them, don't go to the games, whatever.
And LeBron James didn't stop a basketball game to say these things. It was in his off hours, in an interview setting, in a video. He wasn't wearing the basketball uniform. So, yeah, I mean, when he's not doing what he does, if he's not, you know, charging you an entertainment dollar and then grabbing your ear and talking to you about this stuff, then, yeah, of course he has every right to say what he wants to.
Right. He's a basketball player, but who gives a shit about any of this? This is making a story out of nothing.
Exactly.
You know? You get a stupid radio show host. We are not of that ilk. We are a higher grade. We are of higher, you know, we're of higher breeding. I mean, let's face it.
Of course.
We're not cats, but we're also professionals and adults, you see. you know, you have a stupid radio show host with a very, very select audience. And you have a basketball player. I'm sorry, he's just a basketball player. He seems like a nice guy. He seems very charming, funny, entertaining. He certainly was good in a lousy movie like, what was that Amy Schumer movie?
Oh, Trainwreck.
Which she is.
Yep.
I mean, between him and Bill Hader, that was about the most interesting dynamic in a relationship.
Yeah, right.
What more can I say? I'm not a fan of the Cavaliers. I don't give a shit what he has to say. I'm not a fan of any basketball teams, A, because I don't like basketball, and B, if I did, I'd be a Knicks fan, and the Knicks suck as much as the New York Rangers suck, who manage now managed to lose 3 games in a row. Today, most embarrassingly, 7-4 to the shitty Philadelphia Flyers. If I hear one more fucking person say Henrik Lundqvist is a great goaltender and it's not his fault, he's going to get a beatdown from me. See, that's how you respond to these things, because shitty goaltending, guess what, Junior? You're a member of this team. It's not the players in front of you only. Your job is to protect the net.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? You're going to fall asleep at the wheel. The puck's going to go past you. You're going to defend him. I'm going to hit you.
Well,
it's a very simple process.
And I'm going through exactly the same thing, because this was supposed to be the year that the Sabres were at least going to start along the path of putting everything back together. And what's killing them? Goaltending. They have none. They have none. It's
terrible. Who's your goaltender anyway?
Oh, some punk kid. I don't even remember his name. I saw him play here in St. Louis. And he's terrible.
But John, there's one excuse you can give to him. He's a kid.
Yeah.
Henrik Lundqvist has now been the Rangers goaltender for, what, a dozen years?
Right.
And he's got this enormous contract that's a real albatross to that team. And for all the carping on about what a wonderful goaltender King Henrik is, and, you know, he would win a Stanley Cup if he just was traded somewhere else. You know what? He won't, because he was in the Stanley Cup Finals and he fell asleep at the wheel. Not just the whole team. He fell asleep at the wheel against the Los Angeles Kings. The Rangers, who won that season with the highest total of points by any team in NHL history, managed to choke in 5 games to the LA Kings, who weren't particularly great at that moment. They were pretty banged up, but they went in there and they played with a lot of firepower, because the Rangers did what they always do. They played with no heart.
Right. Robin Leonard, by the way, is Buffalo's starting goalie right now. And yeah, he's not doing terribly well at all.
As a kid, I'll give him a break sooner than I would somebody like Lundqvist. I don't want to hear the Lundqvist apologists anymore. A real hockey fan understands these things. The Rangers are not in the middle of a rebuild. When you're in a rebuild, everybody goes. So you get rid of Lundqvist, you get rid of Staal, who's another nightmare. Nash, useless. You couldn't even get a bag of pucks and a roll of tape for your sticks for him. You know, he's one of the biggest busts. And I didn't like the trade when they first made it. But I went off on a tangent. I'm sorry. It's just that now my blood is boiling all over again.
That's okay.
Between idiots with their BlackBerry allergies and being bitchy about a stupid cartoon movie and shitty goaltending from Henrik Lundqvist and then people making excuses. You know, next thing I'm expecting to see is hashtag Henrik Lundqvist Lives Matter.
I hope not. That's all I can say. But it does bring us to the serious news of the week. And what happened in Florida this week, again, how many times can we go through this? And how many times can we go through exactly the same thing? Where the only interesting sidebars to this story, outside of the obvious, going through the lives of the victims and the people who did really heroic shit. I mean, honest to God, the one gym teacher who lost his life because he was shielding kids from a guy with an AR-15.
Two of the kids, one who's in the hospital and one who died, they also used themselves as shields.
Yeah, I mean, that was the only thing that could buoy up anybody's spirits in the light of all of this. But the fact that it has now been... well, how many days has it been? 5 days since that happened. And in the aftermath of it, it took hours, if that, for the Russian bots to start weighing in on this thing and floating fake news stories about who this kid was, the shooter I'm talking about, and what he did, and, you know, and then contradicting themselves and contradicting other stories to the point where by the time anybody got any news out of this at all, it was so completely garbled that it gave a skewed view of what was the motivating factor behind what this kid did. And the fact is that, you know, we now know, but there's so many reasons not to trust anything that you hear about this. I will say this, though. I'm heartened by the fact that, to the best of my knowledge, and you can put it in the comment section and call me an idiot if I'm wrong on this, but to the best of my knowledge, ABC, NBC, Fox, CBS, CNN, MSNBC, none of them got screwed over by it. None of them ran with bullshit news stories and then had to retract anything. So far, the record has been pretty good, and I wonder if maybe they're finally getting to the point where they can do something like this without letting the rumor mill run away with them.
It's a good question. I mean, I didn't hear of these stories where retractions were necessary, so I can't comment on that. What I will comment on is this. Never mind the fact that this is, yet again, the umpteenth horrific story that we're talking about. This is number what for this year alone? 18?
Yeah.
Something like that? You and I have said it before, unfortunately. Nothing's going to change. It's that simple.
Right.
I mean, whoever you think you are, whatever magic words you think you might have or inspired thought you might have, I'm sorry, don't waste your breath, your time, your energy. Do something constructive with it. Find a different avenue, because there's nothing that you can say that's going to change people's opinions when it comes to this whole gun control thing. The question of what's it going to take, that's a moot question, because it's already taken more than enough lives to already have answered that question ad infinitum over the decades that this has been going on, you know? I think Columbine should have been the first and only time, you know, that it really should have been taken to task. But there you go. On a political battlefield, it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. Bill Clinton was the president at the time. He didn't do anything to put a stop to it. It's that simple.
Right.
So, you know, you can try and blame Donald Trump. It's the way. And I'm not making excuses, you know. Not at all. I don't own a gun. I have never fired a real gun in my life. I've never even been in a room with a real gun, frankly. And I don't have any problem with that. Very simply, we are a country filled with very sick people. And what's the common denominator with all these kids that have been going out and doing these school shootings? They're all on medications. Where are the parents in all of this?
Yeah.
Where's the culpability of the parents? And knowing what kind of medications their kids are taking. But then we're going to get into the most obvious thing of all. What the fuck happened with the FBI dropping the ball and then some on this? Now, before we get into that, I don't know if it made the news to St. Louis. I don't know how much truth there is in these, but there were two stories. One, there was a story in New Jersey that was almost a copycat of this.
Yep.
Where the kid never got to go out and do this, but they found him making plans to go out and commit a school shooting. They knew about this previously, but they couldn't charge him because there was no proof, and he had said whether or not he said that he was going to do this or hadn't said it. That still remained to be seen. But there was two stories, one in Maryland, and I admit I can't remember the second one, where a father turned in his daughter to the police.
Yeah, right.
He found her notebooks and all the things that she was planning on doing. And then there was a grandmother who turned in her grandson.
Can you imagine the heartbreak involved in that? For a grandmother to have to make that phone call. And God love her, she did it. But, geez, I couldn't even fathom what must have been going through, the emotions that must have been coursing through her when she picked up that phone.
And the same applies to that father who turned in his daughter.
Yeah.
So let's make this very clear. Anyone can be a killer.
Right. Right.
Doesn't matter. Male or female, black, white, it does not matter. Anyone can be a mass killer.
When I was a kid, for a while, when my mom went back to work, so I would have been probably about four, maybe three or four. She used to drop me and my sister off. My sister's 5 years older than me, with this lady, Mrs. Zimmerman, who was the old lady who ran the in-home daycare. And she was a crotchety old lady, but we all loved her. She was great. And what the other story that got missed this week reminded me of her, and here's why. It was a story out of Alabama, and it happened the same day. And in fact, it happened a couple of hours before the shooting happened in in Florida, okay, in Parkland. So what happened was daycare is there. Mom and dad have a custody dispute. Dad shows up at the daycare to get the child, and I don't remember if it was a boy or a girl, but he shows up with a rifle in his hand. And because he knows he doesn't have the rights, he doesn't have custody of the kid, and he knows the daycare knows he doesn't have custody. So he shows up with a rifle in his hand, and the old lady who runs the daycare walks out, sees him with a rifle in his hand, and he says, "Give me my kid." And she says, "No." Now, this is an old lady standing there in the doorway of her house, refusing this guy entry to her house. And he said to her, "I will shoot and kill everybody in this place if you don't bring me my child." And she says, "I'm not moving. If you want to get through me, you're going to have to kill me." And he backed down. He backed down. And she called the cops, and the cops went and got this guy. And because she didn't, I mean, she avoided tragedy because she had more balls than anybody in Congress, more balls than...
But, John, there's unfortunately a big but. Most sick people who would just go anywhere armed with a rifle anyway would probably shot her.
Right.
That's, you know, this is, dare I say, an exceptional case.
Yeah.
Because he really didn't have the balls to do it.
Right. And I, you know, all I can say is I'm glad that it worked out the way that it did. But, you know, I was so in a day full of that kind of heartbreak of watching those kids and hearing the parents and seeing the screams and the cries and everything like that on TV, hearing that story. And I thought, wow, finally, you know, somebody actually stood up to somebody like this, and it worked out for the best. So, you know, I don't know what more can be said about it. Like you said, if nothing happened after Columbine, nothing was going to happen. Shit, if nothing happened after Sandy Hook, nothing was going to happen with a bunch of five-year-old kids. They've already done it. They've already done it several times this week. You hear people say, well, maybe this will be the thing that finally moves the needle. No, it won't.
No, not at all. And you're deluding yourself into, unfortunately, a very tragic state of mind, because no matter what, it's not going to change. It's that simple. Now, you know, the whole thing with the guns is, I know this is kind of a stretch, but think about this. You know, in New York City, you know, or in New York, period, we've never, thank God, ever experienced one of these things.
Yeah.
Why? Because here's the thing. What's the one of the main common denominators whenever it comes to one of these mass shootings, whether it's that guy in the church in Texas or here in Florida? They all have their guns legally obtained.
Right.
Right? Whenever you hear about a shooting in New York, especially in New York City, there's always an illegal gun involved.
Oh, you know? There has to be, because you can't get one.
Right. If I wanted a gun, I can easily get a gun simply because – and I say easily because I've never been arrested. I have no police record. I'm not on any kind of antipsychotic or psychotropic medications, nor am I under a doctor's care. However, I would have to go through a very rigorous process if I wanted to obtain that gun. And that includes, you know, a background check. I think you have to take mandatory classes on gun ownership and responsibility and how to use the weapon and conceal, you know, where it can be concealed in the home. We are not an open carry state, et cetera, et cetera. But if I wanted to get a gun for the protection of my own home and family, then I can do so. But the thing is, nobody in New York is stupid enough to get a legally obtained gun and go out and commit one of these mass murders.
Right.
Nobody's done that. Thank God for that. I'm grateful because, you know, let's face it, you wake up and you get on the ferry in the morning, you're thinking, could one of these motherfuckers have a gun? Could one of these motherfuckers have a bomb? You know, it's – but you can't live life like that, unfortunately. That's the other thing. It's in your mind now because this is what we've allowed to happen. We have allowed this to happen and to continue. You know, we never – you and I didn't grow up thinking about these things. You know what we grew up thinking about when we went to school? Being finished with school for the day and going out and playing army afterwards.
Right. Or kickball or whatever. Yeah. And
making sure we were in by 4:30 because the monkeys were going to be on.
Exactly. But with all the proposed solutions and all the talk about this one particular gun, because it does seem to be the gun of choice, it is there as as a military weapon, it's designed to, as efficiently as possible, kill as many people in a short amount of time as it can. That's all that it does. And there is no argument. I put a long treatise on my page about this. There is no argument that makes sense to have that piece of equipment available to the general public, in the same way that there's no solid argument to allow chemical weapons or nuclear weapons into the arms of the public. It just shouldn't be there.
Right, I was gonna ask you, as a layman and one who does not really know guns.
I don't either, honestly. I mean, you know, a little bit, but not anywhere near as much as most.
I mean, very simply put, don't give me this shit about a hunter, because I've said it before and I'll say it again. Yeah. You don't need an assault rifle to go hunting unless there happens to be a pack of bears out there,
right,
who are armed to the teeth and ready to fight back for their land.
Yeah.
To which I say, I'm on the side of the fucking bears.
Exactly. Well,
and you try and shoot with a claw, you tell me. You
right,
know?
And you'll hear people say, well, what if I want to defend my family? From what, the Mongol hordes? I mean, Jesus, where do you live? You
know? And besides, if the Mongol hordes came, they'd be on horseback with scabbards.
Exactly. So, yeah, none of it makes any sense. And what it really comes down to, and none of them want to say it, is they want one because they want one. They want one because it's the biggest, baddest motherfucker on the block. And if that's why you want it, at least have the intellectual honesty to say so, so that we can argue this on its merits. But they don't want to say that because they know it's a bullshit reason to get a gun.
But you're also asking for the world. You're asking for intellectual honesty.
Yeah, I know. Crazy me. So
Unfortunately, that's part and parcel of rationality. And these are irrational people we're talking about dealing with, and even on a daily basis of anything.
Yeah.
And it's not a political point of view either. That's on the right and the left.
Right.
And by the way, you know, who's one of the biggest proponents of the NRA and has been in the pocket of the NRA for a really long time? That fellow who ran for president, who still thinks he would beat Donald Trump.
You mean Boyne?
Guess what? At least Trump is president.
Yeah.
Right. What did Bernie win? Oh, yeah, nothing. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to hear any more bullshit from his supporters. Your boy has been a big part of the whole NRA package for a very long, very, very recorded period of time.
Right.
So it's not like you can because that's the one thing about those people. They deny to the hilt that he's involved in any kind of, you know, chicanery whatsoever, even though the facts and papers are out there, you know, the quote indisputable truth, it's out there. And, you know, I can feel my blood starting to boil. But at the same time, I'm just going to spin this very quickly. We hear that Gibson Guitars is imminently going to go into bankruptcy. What do you make of this?
Not much. And it's not terribly surprising, because music just doesn't. It doesn't require what they make anymore. I mean, pop music especially is all electronic. There's very little guitar anywhere. And as sad as it would be to see Gibson go the way of all flesh, I don't see him going that way. People hear bankruptcy and it freaks them out. But name me a major company that hasn't at one point or another been through a reorganization.
I'm sorry, I was just going to say, plus the names that are still out there, like Gretsch and Guild, they went bankrupt at one time, and they had, you know, ownership takeovers, like Guild had been part of, and Gretsch were both taken over by Fender, you know, and now they're both back to being independent companies again.
Yeah.
You know, Fender has gone through how many ownership changes since, you know, CBS bought it from Leo Fender in the 60s.
Yeah.
I would think that Gibson will probably reshape itself. And something has to do with the CEO and his very bad decision making.
Oh, yeah. And he has. As a matter of fact, a good friend of mine who was the head of the Gibson Custom Shop. And just to put it into perspective, Gibson exists in an office park. And it's an office park just off of Briley Parkway, which is the big loop around Nashville, Tennessee. So as you get off a little bit south of Opryland, you get off and you're all of a sudden in this office park, and it doesn't look like much of anything. And there's three buildings around a curve. The first one is Epiphone, the second one is Gibson, and then the third one around the curve is the Gibson Custom Shop. And that's where they do all the repairs for touring musicians, and it's where they make all the really cool guitars and all of that stuff. And Rick Gembar had been running the Gibson Custom Shop for a few decades now, and he was one of those poor management decisions because they popped him. They let him go within the last year, and took out a whole bunch of the upper management, guys who had been working with the workhorses who are still out there on the road, the Joe Perrys of the world and the Pete Townsends of the world, the ones who had the relationships with those guys, and they kicked them all out. So now, what do they care? It's a different company. It's a different world. So, did they have some debt before? Yeah, probably. And is music changing and going beyond them? Yeah, for the time being. But you know what? It'll come back.
And you know what? One of the biggest problems, as far as I'm concerned, is the fact that their product is way too expensive for what they're putting out there.
Right, and that's the thing. That's what they're really going to have to do.
Not fantastic. They're nice guitars. They're good guitars. You're paying for the name and the legend. You're not paying for quality, because let's face it, Epiphone guitars are far and away better.
Right, and that's what they're going to have to, like the Gibson Custom Shop guitars are amazing, amazing guitars, but those are not the $2,500 Les Pauls. Those are the $10,000 Les Pauls.
Right.
And who can buy one?
Right, who needs that? Are you really going to take a risk of paying $10,000 on a guitar and then never take it on the road because you paid $10,000 for it?
Right.
Things like that, you always have to stop and ask yourself about.
The 1959 Gibson, the legend, the 1959 Les Paul Sunburst, I think retailed for $359.
I wonder what the 53 or 55 gold top with the trapeze?
The 52 and 53, yeah, have the trapeze tailpiece.
And the P90s. You don't by any chance know what they originally retailed at. I'm dying to know.
Right around $300.
Right, those are beautiful guitars, and now they're what, about $7,000 to $10,000 easy?
Oh, the 52 and 53s, if they're in good shape, around $15,000, and the late
remakes, the ones that they reused, because Richard Barone actually had them, because he has a deal
right
with Gibson, and he used it the night of Maxwell's closing.
Oh, there you go. Yeah,
the customized, reissue of the 52, 53 with the, gold.
Oh, yeah. You can get one of those for around $8,000.
How to deal with them. By the way, completely off the subject, but back to guns, Turnabout is fair play. The lions who ate the poacher?
This may be my favorite story of the year so far.
Well, that certainly brought up a very, it was a good week until the thing happened in Florida. This brought my spirits back to not mankind, but lion kind.
Yes. Yeah.
All I can say is good kitties.
Yeah, exactly.
Good kitties. I'm going to give them lots of treats. And if you don't know what the story is, some poacher in Africa went to kill lions. He was armed. They ate him.
They ate him, except for his head. And I like to think that the lions left his head there as a warning.
As a trophy.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. That was. Well, I heard, they asked the lions, exactly what happened. They wanted the lion side of the story. And through their lawyer, he said very clearly, he came at us. He was aggressive. He had a rifle. It was
self-defense.
Right. So # lions lives matter.
Yes. So, I to think of it more as a Kevin Spacey in Seven kind of thing. It's like, what's in the box? So, good job, Lions.
Kevin Spacey. He's been shunned. Don't you remember?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm sorry. Still a great movie. So.
You're talking about Kaiser Sose, for fuck's sake.
Exactly.
Or you're talking about, what's his name? Clyde in Fred Claus, another stellar role for him.
Oh, man. Fred Claus. Hey. And now over the last couple of days, we had the indictments handed up on Friday. I think, it was Friday. Yeah, Friday just before noon. 13 Russian individuals and 3 organizations that do business in the United States out of Russia have now been indicted in the election meddling probe. And okay, I mean, they're never going to get any of them here for trial, but still, it's another indication that it's one less opportunity that the administration is going to have to say, oh, it's all fake news. It's a witch hunt. No, it isn't. This did happen. It was the Russians. It wasn't some 400-pound guy on his couch. It was the Russians who did this on purpose and directed it. And what's next? And that's, they've got Manafort. They've got several other people who have either pleaded guilty or are cutting deals with the feds. They've got 20 hours of Steve Bannon testimony that we don't even know what he said in front of Robert Mueller. And now they've got these indictments against the Russians. And still, they sit there in Washington, D.C. and say, we didn't do anything. Bullshit.
Well, one, what did it really do? I don't think for one moment it affected the outcome of the election, because people voted the way they were going to vote. I mean, that's, you know, unfortunately the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because you and I see something on Facebook, do we give a shit?
Right.
It says, so it didn't, you know, nothing that I may have come across, because I've seen tons of things, swayed me to vote for Donald Trump, because I didn't.
Right.
Very simple, you know. Number two. Who else is involved in this, you know, helping, being helped by the Russians?
Right.
Oh, let's see. You know who I'm going for. I'm going for the juggler, son. Bernie Sanders and Jill Stein. You know, I'm sorry. I may be a Jew, but Hitler missed two of them, and those are it.
Oh, wow.
Those American motherfuckers, those communist pieces of shit. I say just take them out and hang them now for treason.
Well, yeah, and with Donald Trump – you know, for him to constantly take this thing, and he's tweeted like 47 times or something stupid like that since these indictments came out, and every single one of them has been about him. This is a guy who talks about leadership, and he wouldn't know it if it bit him in the ass, because a leader, upon finding out that the Russians had monkeyed around with not one but two election cycles, would call them on the carpet for it. But he can't, because his nose is so far up Vladimir Putin's ass that, you know, we couldn't hear him if he did say something against Putin at this point. So it's unbelievable in context. It's not unbelievable in terms of Donald Trump, it's par for the course, but it's unbelievable in the context of a U.S. president to act this way and to be so goddamn defensive that all he can do is say, see, I told you I didn't collude.
No. Well, that's the problem with him as president, because you've got this big infant in a diaper having chronic tantrums.
Right.
And that's what I hate so much about it, because to me, no matter how you slice it, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, that is an office of sacred standing. That is an office that you have to bear yourself with dignity, because you are the point person of an entire nation. You're the leader of the free world, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
You know, and as much as, you know, it pains me to say it, but thinking about it, the last time we had a decent, quote, leader of a president, someone who bore the office with dignity, considering his entire two administrations were just shit smeared with just everything under the sun, was Clinton.
Yeah.
He was the last one who actually appreciated the position of president. George Bush seemed like a nice man, but completely inept. And I'm being very kind. Obama pissed everybody off in the world, and I don't know, understand how people can actually say with a straight face, oh, Obama restored the United States' good standing with the world. No, on the contrary, he didn't. People did not like him, you know.
Right.
I really couldn't give a shit what other countries think, but the bottom line is he was a lousy diplomat. He was more of an isolationist than anybody I can think of in my lifetime.
Right, but he benefited by the comparison. And so, yeah, I mean, was the opinion of Barack Obama higher than it was of George W. Bush?
Yes.
Yes, it was, but only because George W. Bush was such a belligerent fuck. So
right, and he was dumb, and the two are a very bad combination.
Right, right.
No, Obama was just belligerent, period. Donald Trump is the biggest asshole that ever lived. I mean, that's not a point of, you know, comedic reference. That's a fucking fact. If you were me and you've lived in this city your entire life and Blowhard comes along, you take one look at him and go, oh, shut this fucking guy up. Somebody, please.
Yeah.
You know, he's now the goddamn president of the United States. And that breaks my heart, because, like I said, I don't care who you are. That's sacred ground.
Yeah.
And he's shitting all over the presidency, and I hate it. I really hate it. And it kills me, because as much as I dislike somebody like Mike Pence, who is just such a creepy little weasel,
yeah.
he really is. He's just a and all those others that are in line for that position, whether it's Paul Ryan or whomever, they're all creepy little mealy-mouthed weasels.
Yeah. And spineless and gutless, too, because none of them will say anything bad about him for fear of garnering his wrath, because they have no guts.
But the thing is, Pence, I hate saying this, but I think you understand where I'm coming from. Pence would bear the role as president better than Donald Trump.
Oh, easily. Well,
then again, I would, you would. And I mean, I'm not running yet for emperor, but still, we know that's going to happen. I mean, I already announced it on this show. You know, I'm going to run, and I'm going to destroy everybody out there in the process. My campaign motto is take no prisoners, except those I'm going to take and put in prison.
There you go. Well, I'm
going to operate on the George Carlin ethic. We're going to take one state of the union and make it a giant prison and just put every asshole there. And next big state, I think I'm going to make it Texas, because Texas is nice and big.
Well, it already used to be Georgia, though. So, you know, they've got to have some kind of acumen for this.
Yeah. I like Georgia. You know, Georgia's got some good stuff. They've got Mary Mac's Tea House.
True.
Know? Georgia's got some fine, fine things. You know, but, you know, Texas is big enough to hold, because it's going to be a good portion of this country that's going there.
Right. And, and it's a lousy place to be, too, because it's all desert and it looks like crap. So,
people will drown.
Exactly. The other thing about Mike Pence, he actually made news this week for the first time in forever, because he didn't stand up when Kim Jong-un's sister entered the room, which, okay, fine. I did see the irony in the fact that we have Mike Pence, of all people, protesting something he didn't like by refusing to stand. But aside from that, it was part of the Olympic opening ceremonies, and I enjoy some of the sports, but all of the pageantry and ceremony around the Olympics, I couldn't possibly give a shit.
You know what I'd like to do with the Olympics and everybody involved? I would like to take a baton and just start whacking them all in the knee. I want to hear a collective wail of, why?
Yeah, why?
The Olympics mean jack shit now, because, you know, when we used to send athletes, we sent amateurs. We didn't send professional sports people.
Right.
You know, we didn't. What the fuck is luge? And professional snowboarding? No, that's a fucking hobby.
Yeah.
That's not an Olympic worthy sport. Okay. You know, to me, I don't care even if we were to win another gold medal in the men's hockey. Because
which we won't, but players. Yeah.
But they're all NHL players. I don't give a fuck. You know, when you say to me USA men's hockey, I think of a couple of simple things. Jim Craig, Dave Sill, Ken Morrow, you know, Buzz Schneider.
1980.
You know, 1980. Do you believe in miracles? Yeah, that's it. Full stop. Everybody else, no. That's just stacking your teams. The Olympics mean nothing. And I don't watch them, and I don't give a shit. All I want to know is how many medals did the United States win. Why? I'm not a jingoistic nationalist, but I'm very proud to be an American.
Yeah.
It's called being a patriot. I want us to take home the most. And right now we're behind, of all things, fucking Norway. Yeah. Norway, okay? Do you comprehend that? You know how embarrassing that is?
Well, we do have a couple of more shots at it, though. And the other little tempest in a teacup that happened this week, I don't know if you paid attention to these schmucks, but a couple of sports radio idiots were talking about Chloe Kim, she's snowboarder.
Cute. She's really cute. Well, she's also young.
Exactly. She's 17 years old. And that was
I feel horrible having said that, but she's cute.
Well, she is cute. And the thing is, one of them described her as, and I am quoting here, a hot piece of ass. Now, first of all, you're talking about an Olympic athlete. Second of all, you're talking about a 17-year-old girl. And he got suspended over that, and his buddy was yucking it up with him. Oh, yeah, she sure is. Oh, I can see where you're coming from. Come on, guys. I understand. Exactly. I understand the shock jock thing, but good God.
At the same time, what's her name? Lindsay Vonn's adorable.
Right.
You know, she's a beautiful woman, you know?
Yeah.
Pure and simple. Most of the women that are participating there are gorgeous.
Well, that's why they hand out 100,000 condoms before the game start, because it's the best looking 22-year-old people in the world who are all in one place together. What do you think they're going to do when they're not actually skating or snowboarding? They're going to screw each other's brains out.
You know, the thing is, the only exceptions to the rule that I can think of were Nancy Kerrigan and Tanya Harding. They were nothing to write home about, either one of them.
Right.
One was exactly what you think she was, and the other one was just a horsey-faced, nasty little piece of work.
There you go.
And I saw Dorothy Hamill recently. She's 60 years old, and she's still adorable.
Yeah. So,
I mean, for God's sakes, we were all in love with Peggy Fleming.
Right,
so.
Right. Skating on top of that Dan and Yogurt, man. Or wait a minute. No, that was JoJo Starbuck, wasn't it? Yeah, well, whatever.
Yeah, but she got soiled by being married to Terry Bradshaw, for Christ's sake.
Oh, so that's going on.
You're definitely in the deep doo-doo.
Right.
You know?
But I do, I mean, I love curling. I grew up watching curling. I grew up right across the river from Ontario, and we used to watch the curling matches on the CBC every Saturday morning. So,
John, I want to stop you right there. Don't ever admit that again.
I can't help it, man. I love watching curling. And the cool thing is I've been able to watch now as it's, unfortunately, because of the hipsters, I think it's become that's the same thing as them drinking Pabst Blue Ribbon, you know, that attempt at irony. Vote. Right. And it has. It's garnered some new fans, but I'll take them where I can get them.
Well, the only curling I want to ever see is when people are broken and throwing in a fecal position on the floor, sobbing mercilessly, begging for leniency. That's the only curling I ever want to see and or hear. Because the Olympics to me are just, there's nothing behind them. It's not even political. It's just bullshit.
Right.
These are boring bullshit games. Do you really give a flying fuck about, you know, ice skating? The only skating I want to see is either a really beautiful woman on a pair of ice skates, not doing, you know, a triple Lutz or anything. I just want to see her skating because I want to see like when Katarina Witt would skate.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, you know, that would, or a bunch of guys with a bunch of sticks and a little hard piece of plastic going up the ice and shooting it in a net. That's the only skating I want to see.
Well, I have a couple of problems with figure skating. First, I'm straight. Second,
You're not being inclusive.
No, that's right. I'm sorry. But no, I mean, it's fine. It's beautiful. It's lovely to watch. It's fine. But I hate any sport, and this is not just figure skating. This goes for gymnastics and all of that other crap. Anything where I have to depend on somebody else to tell me who won. Because with curling, I can look at the house and I can tell you whose stone is closer to the center and I can tell you who won the damn game. But if I have to listen to somebody else tell me, oh, no, you didn't understand the artistic expression involved and that's why they got the higher score than the other team did, I lose interest immediately. I don't need somebody else to interpret a sport for me. And the other thing is, it's not a sport because, I mean, if you want it to qualify as a sport, I say the same thing to people who think cheerleading is a sport. All you have to do is when one team is out there on the ice twirling around and throwing each other all over the place, have the other team out there trying to fuck them up.
You just brought up curling again. That's very fucked up.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's very fucked up.
But I want somebody doing a spin, and then I want somebody from the French team to come along and try and shove them over. Yeah, right.
Or an air horn, you know?
Yeah, right.
You know, they're going for the high dive, and all of a sudden you hear it. Right.
Back to school. Yeah,
of course, obviously. You remember what last week was like. The whole thing with the Olympics, though, it's self-congratulatory horseshit.
Yeah.
You know? And what does it really merit for any of us? Is it a feel-good story? Not really. Not really. Not right about now, because it always seems to happen around a time that something fucked up is going on. Like, we're having all these problems with North Korea. Where's the fucking Olympics being held?
Right. Yeah, South
Who's
Korea.
From the Olympics this year? Uh-huh. The Russians. And so on and so forth. You know,
And the other mini controversy this week, of course, was right after Shaun White, another snowboarder, had the run of his life, and you know, after dealing with the injury and everything else, has the run of his life, and he's extremely emotional, having won the gold for the United States once again, and as he's just completely overwhelmed with what's going on, somebody hands him a flag. And because he was just, I mean, exhausted and overwhelmed and all of this, and was crying, let the thing hit the snow. Oh, the flag touched the ground, and wouldn't you know that everybody lost their friggin' minds over it. It's like, come on, guys. First of all, why did anybody hand him a flag in the first place? And second of all, lay off of the dude. Look what he just
did. Back the fuck up. Right. I'm not a fan of this whole snowboarding thing, but he won a gold medal. It's probably the last one that he's going to ever win. It's a momentous occasion. It's joy.
Yeah.
End of fucking story. Leave the man alone.
Right. If you think he's paying attention to what his hands are doing right then, you're out of your mind. So that's the Olympics as it stands right now. We'll see. I'm sure by the time we get together next week, we'll have a good idea what our eventual medal count's going to be and all of that stuff. There is some music to talk over, though. Ring your finger. Hurdy boom boom. So...
Do you have a gold medal to win?
I never plan anything beyond the next couple of hours, and I am in awe of you because you now know what you're going to be doing in March of 2019. What are you going to be doing in March of 2019?
The same thing I'll be doing, I found out today, in July of this year. March 2019, that's how far ahead I had to plot and try. That's the key words, try.
Yeah.
To which I succeeded to get seats for the final show of Elton John's Farewell Tour, leg number one, you know, because I'm sure be, you know.
Is it going to have a third leg? No, I'm just kidding. I had to.
Ladies and gentlemen, the bitch is back. I mean, that's how far you could not get tickets for the fucking November shows at Madison Square Garden unless you were going to pay the StubHub. Bend me over and fuck me in the ass.
Right.
So I managed to get two very, very good floor seats at Barclays Center.
Nice.
Now, I will grant you, I don't like paying $300 and change for tickets, but they're floor seats at this stage of the game. And it's the last time, you know, His Royal Highness is going to be playing there. So, presumably. Keyword, presumably.
Yeah.
You know, as we've discussed in other shows. But I was able to get two tickets, and part of me is going, all right, great. You know, I get to see Elton one more time, one very last time. And at the other half, I'm thinking to myself, is he fucking worth it? Because you and I talked about this just last week, you know, not singing songs in the register that they were because his voice can't handle it anymore, et cetera, et cetera. But I thought about it, you know, in a kind of back and forth kind of sense of dialogue. And I realized, you know what? He's one of the last great artists. I'll put the money down for him. And today I found out Fleetwood Mac is going on tour, and they're playing two dates at Citi Field, July 29th and 30th. So I'm going to attempt to get tickets for one of those two shows. So,
good man.
And it's the principle, because when I saw Fleetwood Mac in 2015, they were absolutely on fire. One of the best concerts I have ever seen anybody do over my very lengthy life. And that's not a grandiose statement, because you have to put it into context. You know, when I was a kid, in my world, Rumours was verboten, because my mother had it, my aunts had it, everybody had it. You know, if you lived in the suburbs, along with Frampton Comes Alive and Hotel California, it was automatically issued to you.
It came with the keys to the house.
Right, you couldn't escape that fucking record.
Yep.
You know? But the fact is, they are such incredible players, even now.
Yeah.
So, if this is going to be the truly farewell tour, you know it's going to be a monster set. I'm sure they'd bring out something like, you know, Green Man Alishi or Man of the World, or, you know, because people love those songs anyway.
Yeah. Well, and you know... I told you before about the concert we went to a little while ago where Stevie was performing solo and Waddy was playing guitar. I mean, holy shit. It was just amazing.
Well,
so,
you saw the same tour I did. Did you see them with the Pretenders as the opening act?
No, it was a singer-songwriter, plays the piano, and I can never remember her name. Good stuff with the concerts. We'll get back to it. Actually, concerts are going to be the theme of In Our Heads this week. But there is one other thing to get to before we get to that, which is Luther Russell. And we have talked so much about his partnership with Jody Stevens and Those Pretty Wrongs, and how great a piece of work the two of them together were able to put together. But Luther Russell, for people who are not aware, has a history that goes far beyond that. Give us some of the background on him, and we'll talk about the new stuff.
Luther Russell is a guitarist, songwriter, and singer, / band leader, bass player, producer. He's a California, he's a Los Angeles native, so let's get that right out there so people don't misinterpret because his name is Luther, because you know how people think. He's not a good old boy. He's got a career that spans about, at this point, recorded-wise, about 30 years now. Going back to when he did his first demos with a band called the Boot Heels, along with his good friend as a teenager, Jacob Dylan.
Hey, yeah, I heard of that kid.
Okay. Now, when you listen to the Boot Heels tracks, the first thought, and it's an inevitability, is you think of the Replacements, when the Replacements were sober, mm-hmm. you know, and able to play with coherency. So you're thinking of the Replacements around the Please to Meet Me period. And that makes a lot of sense because these first demos were recorded around 1988. And the thing is when you hear Luther Russell sing, he is definitely a combination of Paul Westerberg and Alex Chilton.
Yeah.
And that's not too shabby, especially on the Alex Chilton end, because Alex Chilton had a great voice, especially when he was younger. But when you hear the next phase, because that band lasted about 3 years, and then Jacob Dylan went and formed the first version of the Wallflowers, who you would not think were the band that they became later, because what they sounded like at first was a combination of Jacob Dylan's favorite bands, The Jam and The Clash.
Yeah, it was not one headlight, yeah.
Right. You figure that one out for yourselves. But then the next band that Luther Russell had was the Freewheelers, and that's where he kind of made his name. They sound so much like the Black Crowes, and there is nothing wrong with that.
In a red light in a heart, everything is watery blue. Sail on, sex wanderer, upon your feline fire. Say you're so free to love, but you don't want my desire.
I mean, really, you could not tell that it wasn't the Crowes, because he's got that good of a singing voice.
Right.
Definitely gives Chris Robinson a run for the money, you know? But he also did solo albums that, again, nobody seems to realize that he's had this amazingly lengthy career. And now there's this fantastic, and I do mean fantastic, 2-CD compilation and anthology, simply titled Selective Memories and Anthology. And it covers all of this, from those first demos of the Boot Heels all the way to the here and now. The only thing that's not included is the Those Pretty Wrongs material, because it's current.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
you go out and seek those out of your own volition, you know, to which, by the way, they're in the studio working on record number 2. I'm very happy to report. But the thing is, you know, when you listen and you listen to the progression of his songwriting as well, you hear different emphases and influences, like Todd Rundgren, like Harry Nilsson. But then he gets to this point where he kind of made a turn. And there was an album that he did called Repair. And there's a couple of songs from that period, especially Your One Big Lie, which it sounds exactly like Alex Chilton singing, and a Big Star track. But Everything You Do, which could be, quote, a pop radio hit, is Teenage Fan Club, which equals Big Star anyway.
You won't be safe from anything, everything you do. It's always automatic, you're always in a panic to get it done. Even when what you were doing would be the undoing of everyone. So get
It's a wonderful cyclical thing, you know? And there's one track especially, The Sound of Rock and Roll, which sounds like him doing both Chris Bell and Alex Chilton vocally. His self-recorded harmonies are absolutely outstanding.
Yes. And a couple of other things. I'm glad you brought up Chris Robinson, because it's not that their voices are that similar. I mean, certainly similar in terms of quality, but there's two different ways to do a blues track that are really, in my mind, the most effective. And the one is a really world-weary kind of Buddy Guy sort of sound of the vocals. And unless you're world-weary, you're not going to be able to pull that off.
And by the way, throw in there and black.
Yeah, well, right.
Because that's the problem with most of these white guys, especially the English ones. They always try to ape the black blues. you're not going to go through the hardships that these old men went through.
Right.
Period.
And the other way to do it is what Chris Robinson was able to sort of build on from the likes of Robert Plant and so many other, the Who and all of these groups who eventually worked their way into that style of music, which was a kind of a sarcastic snarl. And Chris Robinson did it brilliantly, and Luther Russell does it brilliantly as well. It sounds fantastic. And the song that you've got linked on the page with the review, Everything You Do, shows that on display. But the curious thing about it is he did something, again, getting way too pedantic about the production on this, but he did something that was very much in the vein of good old Dirk McQuickley, where the vocals are double-tracked sometimes. You know what I mean? It's not double-tracked through the entire song. It's double-tracked when it's a phrase that needs emphasis. And then puts his own harmonies in on top of it later on during the pre-chorus and the chorus. And it's outstanding. It really is amazing. And the effect is great, and it makes it his, because I don't think I've ever heard anybody else do that.
Well, here's what's wonderful about that. It's his production skills and knowledge. So you've got not just the writer and singer and guitarist, bass player and keyboard player here.
Right.
You've got the producer at the same time.
That's great.
So, I mean, he really is the proverbial one-man band.
Mm-hmm.
When you get down to it, some of those tracks actually have him playing drums as well. You know, so you were just talking about Dirk McQuickley, but the thing is, he's been dead since 1969 anyway. second of all, I want to go back to one thing. Chris Robinson, by the way, you know, him and his brother Rich, they're Jews. Yeah, I know. Odds are the real last name is Rabinowitz. I'm just saying. Because I knew a Robinson and the real last name was Rabinowitz.
Rabinowitz, sure.
Yeah. And I'll get to a story in a moment about that. Chris Robinson's one main target, because everybody, who's the one guy everybody used to always compare Chris Robinson to? Everybody.
Who?
From the moment the Black Crowes broke out, Rod Stewart.
Oh, right? Yeah.
You know who Chris Robinson ripped off hook, line, sinker all the way through, except he wasn't playing guitar? Stevie Marriott. That was his whole blueprint for everything.
Well, yeah, but a lot of the stuff that the Faces were doing was very much like a lot of the stuff Humble Pie was doing. Marriott, yeah, I can hear that, definitely.
And, well, Humble Pie, the Faces, Steve Marriott quits the Small Faces, forms Humble Pie, Rod Stewart goes into the Small Faces with Ronnie Wood, and thus the Faces were born.
Right.
Same fucking band.
Yep.
But it was Marriott who was – which really surprised me, because – when you watch him, you think right away Steven Tyler for the stage moves.
Right.
Rod Stewart. But no, it's Marriott.
Yeah.
Without the guitar.
30 Days in the Hole. Absolutely. The through line from that into the Black Crowes is indelible.
Yeah. I mean, that was always a thing that I really liked about I love the Black Crowes. I mean, I'm just an unabashed fan.
Yeah.
I just wish they would have stopped. When Lions came out and they broke up, they just shouldn't have come back.
And honestly, I mean, that quality is what separated them in my mind from Jet. Jet wasn't a bad band, but in my mind, they were not what everybody made them out to be, because they didn't have that thing.
Well, because they used a song that had a rhythm like Lust for Life. That's what got them on the map. But look, think about all the bands that came out at the same time as Jet. You know, that really annoying band, you know, Last Night, that horrible band.
Uh-huh.
Strokes.
Yep.
You know, all the new bands that were going to save rock and roll. Strokes, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, the Killers, Interpol, the Rapture, all these fucking bands just sucked.
But what didn't they have? And it's, talent.
Talent?
Yeah. but on top of that, they didn't have the direction. They didn't have the ability to do what Luther Russell does, because if you don't have the studio skills, there was nobody left. Because of grunge, all of the talented producers, Mutt Lang and all of the rest of them, all left rock and roll and started producing country records. So there was nobody left. When those guys came along, they had nobody to direct them to be a Brian Epstein or a George Martin, a studio technician, and somebody who could make the music something more than it was. So it was never any more than it was.
Most boneheads now think because they use,
Pro Tools.
GarageBand and Pro Tools, you know, they're producers. Really? good luck with that, because that stuff always sounds like dog shit. I'm
sorry.
Exactly. It's just tinny and uninspiring, and there's no meat or warmth or anything. It just sounds cold, empty, and mechanical. And I'm talking about genuinely cold, empty, and mechanical, not like early 80s synth pop. There's a charm to that because it's so primitive and almost naive and very childlike and simplistic. That's the beauty of that stuff. You listen to these people, it's like, ugh.
But definitely.
Who wants it?
Pick up Selective Memories and Anthology. It really is. It's an awesome piece of material. And read the review, by the way, on the page.
By the way, and I just want to say, and really, after that, you should really work your way back through Russell's career, because it is phenomenally interesting. And that's what makes an artist worth their while, when they have different phases. So you can sink your teeth into one, whether it's, you know, the Freewheelers, or it's the solo stuff, or certainly those Pretty Wrongs, because there's such a wonderful – there's such a really good natural chemistry between him and Jody Stevens.
Yeah.
You know?
So that brings us to In Our Heads for this week. Again, John Grace and Rob Ross here with you and doing our thing. And please do, whatever we've talked about on the show today, leave stuff in the comments section for us. And, you know, leave all kinds of messages. Let us know what you're thinking about the podcast that we do here for you every week as we begin year number two as a Pop Dose podcast only. And we'd love to hear from you.
We're available, don't forget, on iTunes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right. And, you know, for weddings and bar mitzvahs. So the In Our Heads thing this week, I was thinking about concerts, and I don't even remember what started me down this road, but I was thinking about some of the early ones that I went to, and there were times, and boy, I mean, that was my entertainment. We had a bus line that would go essentially from just outside my front door all the way to Lakeland Civic Center, which is about a 45-minute drive, but it's where every great concert was. And there was good and bad in that as well, because Lakeland Civic Center sounded like a bathroom. But it's still, there were these great bands that used to play there all the time. And so every Friday or every Saturday, I was there with another $7.50 ticket to go see some amazing band. And I saw, I mean, all of the metal bands, all of the punk bands, bands like ZZ Top, who were huge at that time. This is all, you know, early to mid 80s that we're talking about, my high school years. And in all of those shows, I got to see Robert Plant and the Honey Drippers. I got to see Petty and just great stuff. And every so often, I would go to a show just to go to a show. And see a band that I was okay with, you know, nobody that I was really dying to see, but you never knew. I might run into some friends there, or, you know, I'd find somebody to hang out with, or maybe even meet a girl. So used to go to all of these shows, and that's why I saw guys like Jackson Brown, which, by the way, was a really good show. But that's the point. Sometimes, once in every blue moon, I would go to one of these shows that I didn't have that high of hopes for, and somebody would just blow me away. I would either get my butt kicked by an opening act, of all things, or see somebody that I thought, oh, I know who these guys are, and then I'd watch them perform and go, holy shit, that was great. And the first time that it ever happened, and I don't remember who the opening act was, but, you know, somebody mid-80s and middle-of-the-road kind of rock and roll, because they were opening for REO Speedwagon. And I thought, okay, well, REO Speedwagon's fine, sure. And I went, and the entire time that they were out on stage, I was doing nothing but watching Gary Richrath kick ass. The guy was phenomenal. And it made me reappreciate the stuff that they did on the albums, because I saw what he did in concert and then went back and listened to the albums and thought, you know what? Of all things, I think they toned him down. I think when they were in the studio, they actually backed him off a little bit and said, you know what? You know, lay it back, because that's not what this band is. But holy shit, that guy was amazing. And I thought, I'm going to hand this one over to you, Rob, and ask who it was that unexpectedly blew you away in concert.
Do you want me to go first time or most recent?
Let's start with the first time, and then we'll get to the most recent one.
Okay. Well, going along with what you just said about, you know, going to a concert, okay, you know, kind of lackadaisical, you know, and non-committal.
Yeah.
Summer of 81, friends of mine, we were having a jam at his house, and he said, well, we got to call this short because we're going tonight to the Garden. And the guy who was playing bass said, this was a drummer. And the guy who was playing bass said, yeah, and we have an extra ticket. And I was like, well, I'll buy it. You know, who are you going to go see? So the headliner was Van Halen.
Okay, yeah.
You know, with Diamond Dave, of course, in those days. This was on the Fair Warning tour. And, you know, I liked, obviously, I liked things like Ain't Talking About Love and so on. They were good songs. You know, I had Van Halen 1. I had Van Halen 2. Didn't really care for,
1984. Oh, yeah. Right.
So this is before 1984. This is 81. So that's before the 84 album came out. Fair Warning, I'd heard Unchained, and I thought, well, that's a pretty good song. Yeah, okay, well, I'll go. Who's the opening band? And they're called Judas Priest. And I already, okay, because I had British Steel.
Yeah.
I thought, what the fuck? I'll go. You know, it was like $15 ticket, right? So I went. Both bands were equally on par. Yeah. You could have flipped the bill around. It wouldn't have mattered. That's how good they both were. They knocked the shit out of me. Absolutely knocked me out. Now, I don't know if this is cheating because I had already liked and seen this band on their own before I saw them as an opening act.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know if that qualifies as cheating, but we all dutifully trooped out to the old JFK Stadium in the summer of 83 on a 103-degree day. In August, the Police were headlining. And they had three other opening acts, and the very first one on the bill was R.E.M.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool.
But I was there for R.E.M. Madness I'd already seen live. They disappointed me previously. They disappointed me again. They weren't a very good live band.
That's too bad, yeah.
And Joan Jett and the Blackhearts I was never a big fan of. No grievances, just never a big fan. Having said that, I had seen the Police in 81 at the Garden. I think it was their first headlining show, actually. On the Zenyatta Mandata tour, and their opening band was called XTC.
Okay.
So, guess who blew me away there?
Uh-huh, yeah, easy pick.
Now, I went to see The Jam at what turned out to be the final show that they did in New York City in May of 82 at the Palladium, and their opening band was the Raybeats. And the Raybeats were just shit hot. They were like a really great updated version of the Ventures. When I tell you they were on fire with those, you know, those good old fashioned Jazz Masters and Jaguars, and they just played that surf machine gun sound like nobody's business. And I thought they were magnificent. Plus, they were local.
Yeah. You know,
they were a New York based band. And the Jam played like absolute shit that night. You could see Weller was not into it. So that really, really pissed me off even more. But then just a couple of years ago, I mean, blown away and wasn't expecting it was Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
I mean, that show was unfucking real. Followed up, what, a year and a half later by the Stevie Nicks show, Stevie Nicks with the Pretenders, you know, and Stevie Nicks, as you know, they basically had to force her off stage because of the time limit thing. You know, that's how into it she was and how good she was.
Right.
You know, and it was with Waddy playing guitar and all of that. You know, there's so many shows I've seen over the years. The problem is I've forgotten a lot of the opening acts. I mean, I'll give you a good example on some of the bills that I've seen. I'm sure I'm repeating some of them. Like after R.E.M. had been on tour with Squeeze because it was part of the A&M IRS packages. R.E.M. went off on a headlining tour. This was just before the release of Murmur. So you could call it either an in-between tour or the immediate post-Chronic Town tour. Their opening bands were the English Beat and the Bangles. You know?
Yeah.
And you're paying, what, $15 for a three-band ticket? You're never going to see that again. But just think about it. And these were young bands. I was a fan of all three. The Bangles had just put out that first EP. I was already in love, you know? Especially with Annette, the bass player. She was my – oh, God. What a cutie. And, of course, I loved the Beat from the moment that I'd first heard them with Ranking Full Stop. What was it, like 2.5 years before in 1980 when the whole ska thing happened? Out of all the ska bands, they were my choice.
You know,
not
definitely.
The Specials, not Madness, but the Beat. But, again, the thing is so many bands you go to see, you have an expectation, which is never a good thing, unfortunately, because more often than not, most people I know have been disappointed. I always try to go to a show with the idea that I hope it's good.
Yeah.
I hope it's good. Not reject, you know, automatically rejecting the idea that they may kick ass or that they may suck. It's just that I just hope they're good. Now, here's a great example. And going back to my childhood, 1976, I saw two legs of the Kiss US 76 tour. The first one, where their opening act was some guy from Detroit who became known as the Rock and Roll Cop.
Yeah.
You say what you will, the Motor City Madman was nothing less than spectacular and made me an instant fan because he was just such a great act. You know, that was when he just released Free For All, and he was fucking amazing.
Yeah.
And you got to keep it in mind in context. I was 11 years old. How good could, you know, very good for an 11-year-old, a highly impressionable 11-year-old who had already rock and roll obsessions, thanks to his cousin. I went at the end of the year for the second leg of the tour, and the opening act was Cheap Trick. So, and of course, right then and there, I was totally besotted with this band because, my God, they sound so much like the Beatles.
Yeah, right. And they put on a hell of a show, and they still do. There are bands that you will never see phone in a performance, and they're definitely one of them. And, you know, there were two bands, there are two more that I want to toss in here that were kind of unexpected for different reasons. And they were the polar opposite of each other because I did not know when I took a girl to go see Huey Lewis in the News on the sports tour in 1984 that they had, it wasn't even on the ticket, they made no mention of it whatsoever, that a Texas trio by the name of Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble were opening that show. And Stevie blew me away with his playing. However, they had zero stage presence whatsoever. They got out there, they played the songs. The only thing that he said during the entire concert as an aside to the audience was, "Hang on a second, my amp is farting." And he walked over and kicked the amplifier until it stopped and then went back into playing the music. But the music that he played was just unbelievable. The other band was, again, another opening act. I went and saw Twisted Sister for, I think, the second or third time. And the opening act was Y&T. And they had one hit ever, a song called Summertime Girls. But the thing that got me about them is that they had more fun on that stage for the 25, 30 minutes that they were out there than I've ever seen a band have before or since. They were having a fucking blast, and everybody knew it. They turned the place into a party, and they were like, "Here we are, and we're going to do this thing," and it was great. The music, meh. But they were fun to watch.
You know who was like that and who is still like that? The Bongos.
Oh, yeah?
Those guys, you know, I've seen them do shows where their equipment was falling to shit. Right. But they managed, they're professionals and went right through it no matter what. But those guys could not mail in a performance. Richard Barone does not have it in him. And subsequently, the people that are around him, he elevates because his enthusiasm and love and passion for the performance itself, it brings everybody and everything up.
Yep.
And it transcends right into the audience. You know, I have seen him play just by himself, and he is just as captivating, and he's a fantastic storyteller, and when he's been drinking wine while performing, even funnier than you could ever imagine, because he's usually so stoic about everything.
Yeah.
He's also an incredibly, genuinely warm human being, and that translates well to your audience. And when you're in an intimate room with folding chairs, you know, that'll fit about 25 comfortably, that makes it even better. You know, when you can see a band that is just having fun, it's a very, very rare thing, because I don't think I could possibly answer that for you properly if you were to ask me, what's the most fun performance you've ever seen? Because I've seen performers who were a little giddy, but that giddiness turned into clumsy.
Yeah, yeah. I know exactly what you mean.
You know, you're jumping all over the place. I get it. You're on stage at Radio City Music Hall and you're enthusiastic, but you look silly jumping all over the place. Just stay still and play the music. You know, I think the audience will get it if you rock hard. You don't have to be that animated. You know, The Cure had zero stage presence and put me right to sleep. You know, that's what you got.
Yeah.
Susie and the Banshees, on the other hand, didn't say a word to the audience, but they were so powerful with their stage presence, you know, you were riveted through the whole show.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Husker Du, I mean, Jesus. I may have told the story before, I'm not sure, but when we saw them on the pre-release of the Candy Apple Grey Tour in March of 86, and I was feeling lousy. And their opening band, of all things, was Soul Asylum, who were really good.
Yeah.
I was surprised. This is long before anything. This is when they were still on Twin Tone Records, and they had just released the Made to Be Broken album. Husker Du were just amazing. But the problem for me at that moment was, A, I was coming off of the flu, and B, I didn't know a lot of the songs at that point because the album hadn't been released yet. So you're going, okay, well, what's this? You know, that's. But then the show that they did on the next leg of the tour, the return, the victory lap. First of all, their opening act was Dwight Yoakam.
Okay, yeah.
Well, now think about the contradiction, if you will. Of course, they were all label mates. Dwight Yoakam was on Reprise. Husker Du were on Warner Brothers. They genuinely liked him, which is why they wanted him as the opening act.
And
he's
they easy to like. He's a hell of a nice guy.
And the thing is, they wanted to make the audience grow, you know? And Grant Hart, God rest his soul, came out on stage and said before they, you know, he introduced Dwight Yoakam and said, we would really appreciate it if you give him your attention and appreciation because we think the world of him. Will you please welcome Mr. Dwight Yoakam? The audience was terrific to him. And somebody jokingly yelled up at the stage during the set as soon as one of the songs was over. And it was kind of late in the set, mind you. So that's what made it even better. Do Rawhide.
I'll bet he did
it. He just 1, 2, 3, 4, rolling, rolling, rolling. And it was the place went absolutely barmy. I mean, it was fantastic. And, you know, it's funny. We were watching, and over in the wings, Husker Du were watching, and they were loving it.
Oh, I'll bet. Yeah. They're just having a blast.
They were. So then Husker Du come out, and they actually opened the show in a very unexpected way. They opened up with the three opening songs from Flip Your Wig. Flip Your Wig itself.
Yep.
Everything Makes No Sense at All. Right in the middle of the second verse, It Makes No Sense at All, the power cuts out of the whole building.
No.
Right? The guitars are out. The bass is out. The lights are off. Grant Hart's still playing the drums, but everybody is still singing the fucking song. Like one big unison group. And then there's a power surge where it's just like right – nobody missed – he never missed a beat. Nobody missed a beat with the vocals. Power comes back on and all of a sudden you hear Mool's vocal halfway through a word and the whole thing is continuing. And at the end, they just stood there and looked at the audience and they started applauding the crowd. And that to me was one of the – I mean, first of all, nobody ever brings up the fact that Husker Du shared that kind of joy, that joyous moment of what could have been really embarrassing and unexpected and just annoying. But not only did they make the most of it, everybody went with it and didn't bat an eyelash.
Yeah.
And that's a precious moment,
yeah.
You know, kind a truly precious moment.
And that's what you go see live music for. I will leave you with this. I have a movie recommendation for you because I had the opportunity to talk with CJ Ramone this week. And he's not directly involved in this, but he was out there doing a movie premiere in Texas for a movie called Bomb City. You familiar with this?
Is this that punk rock movie where
yep.
punk rockers are fighting with people? And it's on demand right now.
Yes. And that's why I bring it up is it is on demand. Amazon's got it. And I think not Netflix, but maybe, Apple, iTunes. You can get it through iTunes as well. And it's a true story from 1997 about a group of punks who was effectively ambushed by a group of Texas football players in this little town. A bunch of guys who were pissed off because they lost the big game. And one of the punks ended up losing his life in this whole thing. And it's about his story and about what happened to the football players as a result of all of this. It looks fantastic, and CJ is really high on this thing. So check that one out if you get a chance.
And meanwhile, I have to finish watching this movie that I've heard good things about. It's supposed to be a comedy. I'm waiting for the genuine funniness to ensue. But so far, it's been interesting. A movie called The Square. It's a Norwegian film.
Okay.
Oddly enough, it stars Elizabeth Moss and Dominic West from The Wire. Good old McNutty and his going commando all the time.
Right.
And wearing no socks even in this movie. It's so far interesting and very – it looks terrific. I mean the cinematography is terrific. It's just – it's scenic and not claustrophobic on the inner shots, and it's supposed to be a very wry piss take of the pretentiousness and preciousness of the art world. So if they're going to make fun of pretentious artists, by all means.
There you go. All right. Well, Rob Ross, next time, of course, there will be all kinds of things happening this week that we will cover on Radio City. Have yourself a good week, my brother, and I will talk to you again on Sunday night.
Yes, indeed, my friend. Stay well. Enjoy if you have an 80-degree day. Hopefully it'll be a sunny one. And we shall reconvene next week when hopefully this Olympic insanity will be over with. So... until then, hasta luego.